Slate spoiler specials are brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/spoiler.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and this is a Slate spoiler special podcast on Prometheus, the new Ridley Scott sci-fi blockbuster. This is also my first ever remotely recorded spoiler special podcast. I'm taping from WBEZ Studios in Chicago, where I came to do a live podcast, a film spotting podcast, with Adam Kempinar of Film Spotting. Hi, Adam.
Hello, Dana. It's great to be here.
And yeah, we decided to go ahead and spoil remotely, because if there's one movie coming out this summer that absolutely can't really be talked about without spoiling, it's Prometheus. And
right.
Also just one of the most hyped, one of the most anticipated. And as I was coming to Chicago to do your live show with you, I was thinking, oh, the only downside is that I can't spoil Prometheus. And then I thought, what am I talking about? I'm going to Chicago to hang out with movie geeks.
We have mics here. Yeah,
right. We've got radio stations and everything.
I'm a little bit nervous, though. I really have no idea what's going on in Prometheus. I thought we were spoiling Madagascar 3. Is this not the Madagascar 3 spoiler special?
In fact, Adam, I think if you brought the analysis of Madagascar 3 to this spoiler, it might help explicate Prometheus better than Prometheus itself does.
Indeed.
So first, let's try to get through just a thumbnail sketch of the story of what happens in Prometheus, and then we can get to some major spoiling. So
yeah.
Prometheus is the first sci-fi movie, this is true, right, that Ridley Scott has made in over 30 years?
Since Blade Runner, 82?
He hasn't made anything that could be classified as sci-fi since then.
I don't think so.
Because he's been pretty productive, but I guess he's worked more in the action movie mm-hmm. kind of drama genre, right? He made Thelma and Louise, mm-hmm. which I think is maybe his best movie outside of the science fiction genre. But he's sort of tended toward these fair to middling action movies and crime dramas, things like that, right? American Gangster, mm-hmm. Matchstick Men are the titles that are coming to mind.
Robin Hood recently.
And Robin Hood. And now at the age of 74, older than I would have thought he is, he's turning back not only to sci-fi, but to the Alien franchise and making what was very vaguely and enigmatically marketed as a prequel to Alien. Upon seeing Prometheus, I feel like it pretty much is a straight-up prequel to Alien. It's not obscure or remote the way that it relates to the story of Alien. Although none of the characters are mentioned, I mean, I guess they couldn't have been because they wouldn't be born yet when this movie takes place.
Right. And in fact, watching it, I felt like at the end, I think we can just go ahead and jump into some of the spoilers a little bit
sure.
here. You get to the end of the film, I felt like it was going to line up perfectly. In fact, I think a lot of people were watching this film waiting for that moment where we would get to see the quote-unquote space jockey, that character that basically starts everything in Alien, where they land on the planet and they find that creature in that vessel, whatever it's doing there, and basically all hell starts to break loose. That space jockey figure, as it's come to be known, we basically get a shot at the end of this movie that you feel like is that moment. It's almost a replica. It looks just like that moment. You think, okay, this is where Alien starts, and then it doesn't happen. Ridley Scott takes it in a completely different direction. He says, nope, we're not there yet. This isn't happening. And so he kind of subverts where you think it might be going.
To me, that was somewhat of a lazy deferral and a little bit of a teaser for, you know, however many movies are going to come next about
right.
this universe. And I felt like this movie raised way too many questions that it didn't answer, even though I know that it's also a movie about unanswerable questions. But so let's get to the actual meat of the matter. So we start off, I think that the best part of the movie is the first 5 minutes or so, but we start off with these really stunning shots of this seemingly alien landscape. It really does look otherworldly. Mm-hmm. And I suspected at first that it might be a CGI universe, but apparently that was filmed in Iceland and those are real places on planet Earth.
Which is amazing, yeah.
Quite incredible. And so after these, you know, incredible 3D shots, and I did think that the 3D in these scenes was pretty impressive, we zero in on this figure who's, I guess, an alien, right? It's never really quite explained who he is, but he's this naked, kind of marble-skinned, extremely cut-looking, buff alien who we witness ingesting this weird substance that sort of looks like bubbling caviar
black
to me.
Goo.
Right. And it seems to be some sort of engineered substance. Then he dies in a spectacularly gross way. And the organic material of his body kind of falls into this spectacular waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a CGI style close up of this of mutating DNA, basically, if I remember it right, or
right.
cell formation or something. And so the idea is that I guess he's somehow sacrificed his body, melded with whatever this substance is to create new life.
Yeah.
Okay. And
yeah.
I actually thought that was a really, really rich beginning and that the mythology that was being laid in place was going to kind of blossom into this incredible thing. But I don't think I'd ever really quite understood what the relationship of that guy's death is to life on Earth. He's supposed to have somehow created humanity in that moment.
I think that's the implication, or at least that's what I took away from it as well, is that, yeah, there's no Adam and Eve. There's this engineer, as they call them in the film. That's their word for these creator figures, these godlike figures that they have a hunch may have created humanity. And this character, just like we got the space jockey in Alien, we have this character who's come to be known in the Alien lore as the sacrifice engineer. There's this notion that he's sacrificed himself to then, as you said, kind of spread his DNA and start life. He's doing this for mankind, to create mankind. I think it's supposed to harken back on some level to the title of Prometheus and this character of Prometheus, the Titan god who stole fire from Zeus to give to mankind. This character is similarly sacrificing himself.
Oh, interesting.
To create
I had read Prometheus.
Humanity.
I had read the metaphor of Prometheus, which is the ship's name, the name of the spaceship in the movie, as that the Earth people were the Prometheans, that they were the ones who were doing this Greek kind of hubristic overreaching, trying to find the origins of life.
I think that's probably there as well. But yeah, that was something that occurred to me, that maybe he's almost this Promethean character who's giving himself up. Does he know that he's doing it? Is he doing it with great intentions? Does he know even what's going to happen? How do we know? You know, does Ridley Scott and the writers know? But there's this notion that he is giving up his life to create more life.
To me, the deep mythology is going a little too deep there, because even this term sacrifice engineer that you say never appears in the movie. Maybe that's part of
course,
the fanboy lore, but it's
exactly,
not something that's ever explained in the movie.
No.
So after this weird sort of prologue where we see that happen with no explanation, we cut to, I guess, the present day of the movie, which is 2089, I think, when it begins. And these two archaeologists in love, who I'm not going to be able to stop myself from being making fun of the entire time, played by Noomi Rapace and what's the guy's name?
Logan
the Tom
Marshall
Hardy lookalike?
Green.
Logan Marshall Green. And so they're a couple, and they're also archaeologists. And we see them exploring this prehistoric cave where they witness this kind of scene that they've seen in archaeological sites all over the world, where early man is shown reaching for this kind of formation of five stars, right? And in a big leap, they make this extrapolation that this must mean that alien life somehow contacted early man, and that out there somewhere are the origins of mankind. And then we skip ahead only 4 years. And in 4 years, they've managed to get a very rich tycoon, played by Guy Pearce in loads of age makeup, to underwrite this space mission to go and find the origins of human life, right? It seemed like a very fast – the grant writing process must have been very successful.
Exactly.
Because it's a pretty crackpot notion. But they managed to get this 17-person crew on the spaceship Prometheus, and they're heading out into deep space to go to this Earth-like planet. Why? Just because it's an Earth-like planet, they think that has to be the place. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
But they're heading off for the moon of this distant solar system, of some planet in a distant solar system, to try to find the origins of life. So let's go over who's on the ship. Let's outline the crew here.
You've got Shaw, as you said, Noomi Rapace, and Charlie Holloway, played by Logan Marshall Green, the couple. And then also Charlize Theron plays Meredith Vickers, I believe her name is, who is kind of the corporate overseer. In some ways, she's kind of like the Paul Reiser character in Aliens, who's there to make sure everything just runs smoothly as it's
supposed
to.
So you wouldn't say she's the commander of the ship? Is Idris Elba the commander of the ship?
Idris Elba, he's the captain of the ship. And that's one of the things that comes up throughout the film is who's really in charge here. It's a scientific mission. And at one point, even when Waylon appears via holograph or whatever.
Waylon being the Guy Pearce
character. Waylon, the Guy Pearce character, who is supposedly dead. He appears and speaks to them and lays out this mission. He says that Holloway and Shaw are in charge, but we also have a captain, Idris Elba, as you said, and we also have Meredith Vickers, who runs the ship like she's the captain. So you have different interests here, obviously trying to be served as this film goes on. Those are the main characters. There are also
some... David. Don't forget about David.
Oh, yes. We can't forget Michael Fassbender as David, the android who plays a really large role in this film. In fact, I would say in many ways it's his film. He's largely the protagonist of this movie. He drives a lot of the action of this film and is really fascinating to watch. I'm a big Michael Fassbender fan. I think this is a great performance of his. I loved watching that droid character be a variation on previous droid characters, very different than, for example, Ian Holm in the first Alien.
Right, or HAL 9000, who he also sometimes occasionally echoes, or Jude Law's character in AI, right? He seems like he's incorporating the history of android characters while making something that's completely his own. I agree with you about Fassbender. I mean, he really has this almost superhuman gift to save movies. I wouldn't say he saves this movie. I think this movie has a lot else going for it, although on the whole, it never finally worked for me. But Shame, for example, was a movie I think you liked a lot more than me, but at once I thought the movie was absolute tripe, and then I thought Michael Fassbender was brilliant in it. So he has that power.
There's no doubt he was, and there's something really interesting about his character where he is a droid, but he acts very human. And I love that touch, because what they set up in the film is that he's a character who has been studying for years while they're all sleeping for that 4 year span. And before that, presumably
in suspended animation,
sleep or whatever, he has been studying human beings. He's been trying to understand them. He's been trying to be more like them. In fact, there's a great scene I love in the film where we cut to that ship and he's watching Lawrence of Arabia on TV. And in fact, he's trying to make himself look more like Peter O'Toole.
Right, he dyes his hair. Although why he has to dye his hair, I don't quite understand, since he's not organic. Why does his hair grow?
Yeah, that's a good point. But he's studying him, and I don't think it's by accident that he's watching Lawrence of Arabia for a couple reasons. I think you can make the argument that that Lawrence character in some ways is the model of an Englishman and maybe the model of a man. And of course, when you're dealing with a film where this whole issue of what defines us as humans and striving to be human, there's even the suggestion, perhaps, there's this Pinocchio element to David, where it almost is suggested that, does he want to be a real boy? You know, does he want to be...
And real boy is used, right? At one point,
that
the Charlie
phrase
Holloway
is used
character
at one
says,
point.
You're not
yeah.
a real
and
boy.
And so that kind of invokes that. So he's looking at this human ideal, and he wants to be like him. Of course, I also don't think it's by accident that the scene from Lawrence of Arabia that they pick is a scene in which Peter O'Toole is holding the lighter, or he has the match, and he's doing the trick where he can hang on and not let it bother him. He says the trick is to not let the fire bother you. Of course, again, harkening back to Prometheus stealing fire from Zeus. I think it's another callback to Prometheus there in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, I loved the scene where the android watches Lawrence of Arabia, including just the imagination of technology in it, which was sort of Blade Runner-like. I loved the quick moments. There weren't enough of them where this movie just imagined not just the aliens of the future, but the sort of domestic technology of the future. And he's in this kind of wraparound room where the screen almost makes like a half moon shape around him, and especially in 3D with the high definition, it just looks great. It makes you wish that you were in that future when you could watch home movies that way.
Yeah, and I think for me, one of the real strengths of this film, and it sounds like it did ultimately work for me. I think there are a lot of issues I have with it, especially in the second half of the film, but I think I liked a little bit more than you. And one of the things I really respected about it and was keying into was something that he did in Alien as well, which I love the way Ridley Scott thinks about scale. And I just think of some of those glorious shots, not only at the beginning of the film, as you said, with the waterfalls that seem like they had to be CGI because they're so overpowering, almost they're so huge, but when they land on that planet and you see the epicness of those shots, and even when they're in these tunnels and they're looking around, they basically are looking for these engineers. They think they might be in this cave system, and they go through there. The way he shoots the humans in that space just really minimizes them and constantly shows sort of, it reinforces the folly of what they're doing, that they're way out of their element here. They may think they're godlike and they have the power to go talk to the people who created them, but they're up against forces of nature here that are really beyond them.
I agree. And you're citing all the things that I really loved about the movie now, and why I liked the first hour so much, and why I was patient with all the murky details of the story and the motives of the characters and what the deep mythology was all going to finally mean. I was really patient with that up until, I would say, the last half hour or so, because I really appreciated the universe that the movie was building and how fun it was to be invited into it. But then once they do start finding the aliens, I mean, please tell me you experience some disappointment at that part in the story.
Well, it depends what part you're talking about. When we first meet the alien, when they first go into this lair and we see more of that black ooze and something is going on, they've somehow disturbed the temperature in the room and they've caused things to go a little bit haywire. When that first starts happening and we first see the creepiness or the gore factor, that really happens more when they get back on the ship, I think, which I think we can obviously talk about. They get ahead of one of these engineer figures back to the ship, and that's when we get the first kind of really gory sci-fi special effects moment. All that stuff I liked. I loved the creepiness of that. It made me think of Alien, when you have this movie that's just kind of humming along, scientific mission, everyone's going about their business, then all of a sudden horror, this jolt of horror. I really like that. Where they start to get into trouble is with these two other characters that are almost there for comic relief. Fifield, I think his name is, and Milburn. And they get lost. They go off on their own. And first of all, that doesn't really make any sense because they've mapped out this entire canyon or whatever they're in, and they're in constant communication with the captain. So it seems kind of ridiculous that they would somehow get lost, but the movie needs them to get lost, basically. And there's a moment where you've got these figures who are very scared, and they see this slimy snake-like figure or whatever come up out of the black ooze, and they basically go right up to it and let it attach itself to them. And you're thinking, really? I mean, you're on this foreign planet, this foreign creature, and you're just going to go up to it and treat it like it's a nice cat you want to pet.
Yeah, no, these guys violate the Star Trek Prime Directive like there's no tomorrow. And then that guy's a life scientist, a biologist, the guy who comes right up to that weird slimy gray snake creature, beautifully art-directed little thing that's sort of really sexual. It's sort of like penile and vaginal both at once. And it's just really, really like ooey. And he just grabs right for it. Oh, hi, little buddy. I mean, right. he kind of deserves to bite it at that
he
moment.
He does, yeah.
Those guys both die in a horrible way. And then during the investigation to go and recover their bodies, or to discover what happened to them, rather. Oh, it's on that mission, right, that that David puts a little bit of – he essentially poisons Charlie Holloway, the
yes.
scientist, the
this
male
the,
member of the scientist.
One of the key
couple.
Questions of the movie, yeah.
And so here's what we couldn't spoil last night. It was really fun talking about Prometheus with you guys last night at the live film spotting. But we couldn't really get into
couldn't
the
get
down
into
and dirty details of, I think – maybe the overweening question story-wise, dramatic conflict-wise of the movie, which is what are David's motives, right? Why does he slip a Mickey, basically a sort of alien Mickey, into the drink of Charlie Holloway and thereby sentence him to a really horrible bodily invasion and death?
Yeah. Absolutely. This is one of the fundamental questions of the film. I know when I walked out, the first thing I said to my co-host, Josh, who was there at the screening with me, was, okay, what's your take on that? Why did he do it? Because there are so many potential motives that come up throughout the film as the story goes on, one of them being that what ends up happening is we're told early in the film that his girlfriend, the archaeologist Shaw, is unable to have a baby. They have sexual relations the night that he gets infected with this black goo, and we come to find later that she's been impregnated with a creature, with obviously something that comes from this black goo.
So you think that David foresaw that whole outcome?
So that's the big question, because the movie almost makes it seem like, did he know that? Was that his end goal? And he's very protective of the fact that he wants to put Noomi Rapace away in a cryo sleep and bring her back to Earth or wherever they're going. And there's sort of this notion that goes back to Alien that we want to study this, and maybe he's got some motives that are ulterior, and perhaps he planned this all along. And then you start to ask, well, could he really foreseen that they'd have sex that night? And probably not. My take on it is actually, as much as there are some interesting theories I think we can throw out, I think it's actually one of the more practical things about the film that I think the film sets up. There's a point in the film where they go down to that planet, and as we said, they find the head of one of the engineers. And the whole point of this mission is to talk to their creators, to talk to these characters that they've called engineers. And as we learn later, as we spoil this even more, is that the boss, Mr. Whalen, is actually on board the ship. And this is all about his goal, ultimately, about finding the key to immortality.
Right. So Whalen wasn't dead after all.
He wasn't dead. He's there to talk to his creators and presumably find some secret elixir, or find out what the secret is to being like them, to living forever. That's his ultimate goal. And they find that head, they bring it back to the ship, and Shaw does some experiments on it where they think maybe they can get this thing back to life, essentially, and it does come back to life and starts to freak out so much that they have to destroy it. So
in a very thing-like moment, very John Carpenter-esque.
You're right. And so that's the moment in the film where that's their one chance to talk to their creators, to essentially talk to God, their God. It created them. And it fails. Not too long after that, there's a scene where we see David talking to someone, and we don't know who it is. And Meredith Vickers comes up and says, what did he say? And what we can piece together later is that he was talking to Whalen, that Whalen has actually been giving him some orders. And I think that what was happening is David was filling him in on the process, and Whalen said, try harder, right? That's what Vickers says. What did he say? And Michael Fassbender says, he said, try harder. I think the implication of that is they had this shot at figuring out the secret to immortality, of talking to the engineer. Do something else. You need to do something drastic to find some solution here, to take the next step in the
right.
scientific
and that's
process.
When he gets the idea of the
poisoning. He gets the idea that he found this black goo that is clearly something organic. There's clearly life here, and it can cause life. And he just decides to use Charlie as his guinea pig.
Right. So he doesn't know what's going to happen to him.
I don't think he knows what's going to happen. I think
to bring the organism home in his body in some way.
I think he's essentially following orders. Now, I love to speculate that David himself may have other motives that maybe he could have foreseen. We know that he knows lots of intimate details about Elizabeth Shaw's life. So he may know that she can't have a baby. And he might be playing some kind of interesting game where he's going to say, okay, you came here to find God, to mingle with your creators. Well, the only way to know God is to try to be a God yourself. And he sort of gives them the ability to create life, which otherwise she didn't have before. So I think there's potential things there. Maybe he just wants to study the creature that she's eventually going to give birth to. And there's those elements. But I think ultimately at its core, he's following orders. He's doing what Whalen wants him to do. And I think that he doesn't know what's going to happen when he infects Charlie. But he knows something interesting is going to happen. And so he is going to use him as his guinea pig. He's going to infect him and see what happens and study him and see if something comes out of it that then by taking that engineer's DNA, maybe that's the key. Maybe that's what's going to ultimately let Waylon live forever.
I want to talk more about belief and faith and doubt and how all of that figures into these various characters' motives and into the movie's mythology as a whole. But first, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. This week, the Spoiler Special is delighted to be sponsored by Audible. It's one of my favorite sponsors, actually, because I know that when we're selling Audible, we're selling a product that our listeners will actually use, right? If you're a podcast person, Audible is a natural, and I use it myself all the time. So Audible is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio content on the web. They have more than 100,000 titles, books, magazines, newspapers, radio plays, which you can play on nearly any device, including whatever you're listening to us on right now. And Audible has a special offer for Spoiler listeners. You can get a 30-day free trial and one free audiobook by signing up here, audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. And there you can choose your free book from their vast library. So we usually like to recommend an Audible title that usually has something to do with the topic at hand of the day. And I was searching around under aliens, sci-fi, various, tons and tons of titles came up that looked interesting. But the one that I really felt like downloading and listening to, maybe on my trip home from Chicago, is Life, the Universe, and Everything, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Book 3, the Douglas Adams book. That whole series is just fabulous. And I haven't read it since high school, but I was never a sci-fi person, but I just love the tone, the kind of speculative, crazy humor writing mixed mm-hmm. with speculative science fiction of those books. So they have that book. It's narrated by Martin Freeman, which is also very promising, who was Tim, of course, in the British version of The Office, and who will be the Hobbit in the upcoming Peter Jackson Hobbit movie. I love Martin Freeman, too, and he seems like a natural with his sort of sense of the absurd for reading a Douglas Adams book. So that's our Audible recommendation. So we're more than halfway through the spoiler now, and we still haven't talked about the movie's big, gross-out kind of money scene, right? The one that everybody comes out going, oh, my God. And to me, it was not necessarily an oh, my God of admiration. I'm not sure that I'm quite sure what that scene is doing in there, but we have to describe it as graphic as it is. So as we know, Charlie Holloway, who's the male half of the archaeologists in love couple, has died a horrible death from being poisoned with this alien toxin by the android. The android, David, informs Noomi Rapace's character, Elizabeth, that she's pregnant. And she's pregnant with something that's not human. So do you want to describe the graphic scene that follows from there?
So this thing is growing rapidly. She's 3 months pregnant, even though it just happened 10 hours ago, I think is what she says. And her immediate response is she's got to get this out of her. He wants to put her to sleep and take her back to Earth to study it or do whatever. And when she wakes up and David's not there, she goes in and she uses this piece of equipment. I can't remember the exact name they give it. It's a metapod or something like that.
It's sort of an auto surgery.
It's an auto surgery, right? You put yourself in it. It scans you. You kind of tell it what's wrong with you and it will fix you, which would be a really nice tool to have. And she gets in it and it says, we can't do a cesarean section, which also opens up some questions about why wouldn't it be able to do that.
It's one of my favorite lines in the movie is it says, this machine was programmed for a man.
Yeah, it basically says, sorry, you're a woman.
It can't deal with pregnancy.
Right, which then opens up these questions of, well, it was there probably all along for Waylon. It was designed for him and not for Vickers, who we think it's for earlier in the film. And she gets in it. It says, we can't do a C-section. So she has to instruct it to do abdominal surgery and remove this fetus, if you will, from her body. And what we see play out over, I don't know how long it actually is. It feels like 20 minutes, even though it's probably less than two or maybe even 90 seconds. She has this surgery performed. We see this piece of equipment actually cut open her stomach and reach in and take out this horrible squid-like figure. And then we see that squid-like figure, as it's being held, kind of trying to attack her, or it's got its little tentacles getting close to her, and she has to wiggle her way out of this thing.
It's a pretty brilliantly imagined scene in terms of the choreography, right? The
blocking. Her stomach stapled back up so that, you know, she can be put back together. It's horrifying, and I imagine that maybe you might have had a different reaction to it being a mother than I did, where maybe it was even more horrifying, and I was watching it from the pure, visceral, intense level of a great action scene where I was just horrified. I was there in my seat, like almost cowering because of the intensity and the horror of that moment. And I could put myself in her shoes and imagine that thing being inside me and wanting it out as fast as possible.
And that it's worth it to have unanesthetized auto surgery.
Just get it out as fast as you can. And
well, I have to say, I mean, the scene itself was incredibly effective. What didn't work for me was just the plausibility of everything that came after. It just all happened so quickly within the space of a few minutes. And so the idea that with these stomach staples in her body, she's going to go on to have like three more action scenes in a row.
Like right away.
Why does it need to be paced quite in that way. I actually think it really would have added to the movie, not just its plausibility in terms of the healing process from your alien abortion, but
right.
but just in terms of the character development on the ship. If instead of immediately running from that in her skivvies to go fight some more aliens, that, you know, she had sort of reintroduce herself into the life on the ship. Maybe she has to cover up the abortion. Maybe she has to, you know, tell David that she didn't do it or something. I don't know. I don't know what could have happened. I'm not going to replot the entire movie. But the plausibility for me started to fall apart after that moment. It just sort of seemed like we were having extreme things thrown at us for the sake of being extreme.
I agree that that's where, after being very careful about setting up this film, what ends up happening, setting up all the stakes and who these people are, in that last 30 minutes or so, what ends up happening is things like that. They start to kind of lose some of the key details in a hurry to get everything moving forward. And not only is it just kind of unbelievable that she would be out there doing all the things she's doing, what happens too is that no one seems surprised. No one on the ship really seems to be aware of the fact that she just went through this horrible process. and even that, no one seems to be aware of the fact that all of a sudden this guy who was supposed to be dead, Waylon, the mastermind behind all this, he just shows up, and you have people like the captain, Idris Elba, just taking it for granted that he's now alive and he's out there looking for the engineers. I mean, imagine being that captain of the ship and finding out that you've been stowing away this guy who's supposed to have been dead for 2 years. There's never a moment where we see anybody on the ship reckon with that. It's just sort of taken for granted that oh yeah, okay, this character's here and now he's going to be injected into scenes. There's something missing there that you wonder if some things got cut, and there will probably be a future Ridley Scott cut that fills in some of those holes.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciated the more stately pacing of the beginning of the film. And then it almost seemed like, I don't know, as you say, if it's a result of cuts or the need to ramp up the action so that it can pass as a summer blockbuster. But it really did seem like things became all about, you know, running down dark corridors from gooey, screeching creatures for the last half hour. And it's not that the gooey, screeching creatures weren't effective and scary at times, but I sort of started to lose the point of the whole movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's spoil the very last scene. And what happens when they go into, I guess, what I think of as the alien control room, this abandoned, almost like a ship's deck or something, mm-hmm. at the heart of the alien complex that they're exploring.
They do go in and they find that there's one of these engineers is still alive and has actually been sleeping, almost like the humans do, has been put to sleep. And I think the implication is he was put to sleep while these other engineers were supposed to be devising this big weapon of mass destruction, that the engineers have somehow decided that they're going to destroy Earth. They're going to destroy life that they created for whatever reason. And that's what Shaw really wants to get at the end of the film. This is the big question hanging over the movie is, okay,
why would you create
they created
all this
us,
life
but then
only to destroy
you
it?
Want to destroy us, which actually, real quick diversion, I think that's one of the interesting thematic tie-ins back to Shaw, right? She can't have a baby and she's upset about that. And then she finally gets to create life and then she's not happy with the life that she created, and she wants to destroy it, just like the engineers do, right? So we don't really know why, but we know that they want to destroy it. So I think the implication is that they are supposed to wake this figure up when they're done with their mission, and instead they get woken up by Waylon and David and these human beings, and the guy, this figure, the engineer, goes a little mad and says, I'm going to fulfill my mission, and basically sets out to destroy the planet, and they have to stop him. That's their goal.
So I guess what we're supposed to take away from this last scene is that the theological question that's kind of driven the movie, where did human life come from? Why were we created? What do our creators want from us? Why are they asking us to return? Right? All of these big speculative questions that are put in place in the first hour kind of resolve into this muddled mess at the end where the guy is woken up, and understandably, right, he's woken up by alien creatures after thousands of years of sleep. He's not in a good mood.
No.
He destroys them. I don't know that necessarily is an argument against the existence of God, as Waylon seems to say when, spoiler, he is killed by the creature, right? He's lying there dying. The Michael Fassbender android has his head screwed off his body by the creature. But just like
every
Ian Holm,
droid in this
he
world.
Doesn't necessarily die as a result,
yeah,
right?
Bishop in Aliens too, yeah.
Right, yeah. So having your head removed isn't necessarily a death sentence for Michael Fassbender. And there's a really long and somewhat comic section of the movie where his head, his not disembodied, what's the word, his decapitated head is lying there issuing instructions to Noomi Rapace and philosophizing with Waylon. And Waylon's last words as he's dying to the robot head are, there's nothing, is there? Or something like that, right?
Right?
He's essentially saying, after it all, there's no purpose, there's no God, and our existence is meaningless. And I love Fassbender's line reading of his response, right? Doesn't he just say, I know?
Right.
And then he says, have a safe journey or something like that. He's seeing him off into the abyss. Of
nothingness. Which does kind of work because, as we're told earlier in the film, the difference one character says between a human being and the droid is that the human supposedly has a soul. there's something more. And what David is affirming there is, well, actually, we're both the same. There's really probably nothing else for either of us.
Right. But it's really hard to know how the movie feels about
right.
that, because the Noomi Rapace character, on the other hand, has never let go of her faith. She wears a cross throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I think, very heavy-handed drama and talk about the cross and David taking it off of her body and her putting it back. But she, at the end, takes off with the head of Michael Fassbender and his body, but separately, right?
Yeah.
And there's a kind of great scene where she has to lower him out of the cave. She lowers the body first, the headless body, on a line, a rope, and then she pops the head into a bag, apologizing to him as she zips it closed. And the two of them take off at the end. Oh, wait, but we haven't even talked about the destruction of the mothership at
right.
the end.
They have to basically go on a suicide mission. They have to stop this vessel that this engineer is heading back to destroy life as we know it. And she basically, Shaw, convinces the captain that there's going to be no life to go back to if you don't sacrifice yourself and stop this ship no matter what the cost. And all they can do is ram right into it and try to bring it down, which is what they successfully do.
Which I think that kind of kamikaze mission at the end and Idris Elba agreeing to sacrifice himself along with some other crew members to bring the mothership down, the alien mothership, it would have been much more powerful if we had had a better sense of the relationship among the crew the whole
Definitely.
Time. I'm just thinking of Aliens, not a Ridley Scott movie, a James Cameron movie. But one thing that was so great about it was the different personalities on the ship, Bill Paxton, right? The way they all related to each other.
Yep.
And even though they didn't all like each other, they seemed like colleagues. They seemed like workmates.
Yep.
And watching their relationship develop was a huge part
this
of the interest
of the
movie.
This is a problem I had with the film as well. And it's not just Aliens. It's in Alien as well, the first one. You get to meet every character on the ship and you get to know their personalities. There are no sort of anonymous figures running around. In this movie, it wants us to be invested in this moment that happens at the end. Two of these other characters decide to go along with the captain and sacrifice themselves. And other than hearing them joke around a few times, we haven't really gotten to know them at all. And then come to find there are actually a lot of people on the ship who are just anonymous figures that don't have a name, who never speak. And then you lose track of them, as we said, as things are going on. I think that was one of the real flaws of the film is that we don't get to know them.
A more skeletal crew that had known each other better. And if, as I say, if instead of, you know, sort of running around wildly packing in action scenes at the end, if there had been some moment of exposition for each of these characters, how do they feel about what's going on? What does the mission mean to them at this point? Then the ending would have been much more powerful.
Yeah, I think, real quick, I just want to note, because I know I've seen some people bring this up on the internet, there's some disbelief over the fact that they have to ram this ship because they don't have any weapons. And the captain explains, we don't have any weapons because this isn't a military vessel. This is a scientific mission. That does seem a little bit odd, though, because they're going off to this planet. They have no idea what they're going to encounter. You would think maybe a shrewd guy like Whalen would think, maybe we should pack a few guns. We should have a ship that could do some damage if we ever faced any kind of problems out here. And they don't. And it occurs to me that I think it's actually probably just a design of the story where they need everybody to die at the end of the film, right? They need everybody. They have to bring down the ship by killing everybody because the film needs to end with Shaw and David going off on their mission. You can't have anybody else going back to Earth and saying, guess what we found? We found the creators of life. Everyone has to die so that only Shaw is left. I feel like maybe that's the reason why they didn't have any weapons. I don't know.
That would make sense, right? Story-wise, you've got to get everybody out of the picture in order to set up
yes,
the
and
sequel.
Everyone else does die, so.
So at the end, what I thought should have been the end is actually sort of the false ending because there's another little tag at the end that we'll discuss. But Shaw, Noomi Rapace, is taking off with the decapitated robot android. And the idea is that she's going to continue exploring, right? And there's a, I think, somewhat hokey little speech, a voiceover at the end of her saying, I will continue to explore. The idea being that she hasn't given up. She hasn't completely written off the idea that there could be some good. I mean, I think here it actually becomes a question of, is there any good in the universe, right?
Right.
Is there any such thing as goodwill? And is there any way to find someone who's well-disposed toward humans? Or is it really the fact that we're just, you know, flies and that wanton gods are taking us apart for their sport? And I think the movie sort of leaves that question open. I don't think we're supposed to really know the answer at the end. And I don't really need to know the answer to that question. So after their ship takes off, it seemed to me that would have been roll the credits time. But instead, we get one little tag back at the ship you want to describe.
So after that bit with Shaw, they go back to the wreckage of the ship. And we get this classic alien kind of xenomorph moment where we see that engineer that was trying to bring down humanity, we see that infected with the creature actually that came out of Shaw and has now grown to full size.
Which makes you wonder why it needs a human womb, right? If it can
right.
gestate in any kind
well,
of body.
I was wondering that about all the alien films, frankly. Why, after they're born, do they need to go back inside someone? I'm not sure completely about the science there of those figures. But there is this moment where we get the alien birth, if you will, the figure that is going to come to define what we see later in the alien films.
The so-called xenomorph, right? That creature with the mouth that comes out of its mouth. And it is a scary creature, but that moment for me was too on the nose. We get it, right? And
yeah.
It's supposed to be a movie about evolution and mutation and that this creature is constantly mutating. So the idea that generations before Sigourney Weaver comes along, it's already assumed its form, it just seemed to me like a little bit of a sop to the audience, like, here's your alien.
Here's your alien, right. I agree with you. I don't think it was really needed. In fact, I think at the screening I saw it with critics, so maybe they're a little bit more jaded, but they laughed. There was a little bit of a chuckle at the end, like, oh, thanks, you had to give us the obligatory alien. I'm not sure that we really needed it, but, you know, the moment before it, there's no doubt when you're talking about Shaw and David going off and looking for answers, there's no doubt that there's some hokiness to it. I think there's some hokiness to some of the lines. I actually think the score of this film doesn't work really well. There's a lot of scenes that are kind of ominous and heavy, and you've got these swelling strings.
Yeah.
It's really overscored. And there's some lines that are overwritten. And one of them is she has a line where she's talking to David, and he says, why do you need to know? Why does it matter why they wanted to destroy us? And she says, well, it matters to me because I'm human and you're not. And it's just the way it's read. We knew that. We understood the distinction. We really didn't need them to hit us over the head with it. That all said, that moment worked for me still on the whole, because I like the fact that I think what it reinforced is if you kind of look at the film as ultimately asking the question about what defines us as human, which I think Ridley Scott did also brilliantly in Blade Runner, you get this moment where the answer is essentially what defines us is we're always going to be seeking answers. We may never find it, but what separates us from maybe a character like David or these alien figures is that we're always going to feel compelled to try to find the answers to our purpose and why we're here.
I agree. I mean, I love that as an ending. I just think it was too hammered in by the voiceover at the end and the sort of inspirational shot of the ship taking off into the sky. I think even just a conversation between the two of them at the moment she's lowering him down might have done it. If you really think about it, it's quite rich and compelling in itself without any voiceover, without any explanation.
Agreed.
Just the idea of a decapitated atheist android and this Christian believer scientist heading off together into outer space to discover the origins of humanity. I mean, that's so dramatically rich that it actually makes me really look forward to the sequel to this, even though I didn't love the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that this movie needs to step back a little bit from the ponderous proclamations that it feels the need to make and just be a sci-fi movie. I mean, sci-fi has the ideas within the story, right? Like the first Alien, a great sci-fi movie doesn't have to exposit its ideas.
That's true.
It just contains them in the story itself.
Yeah. At the same time, I really like the fact that one of the things I really love about Aliens is that it took the essence of Alien. It picked up right where it left off, but James Cameron did something different with it. It was a new chapter. It wasn't trying to be Alien. It's much more of an action film. And also he introduces this really interesting motherhood angle where we see with Ripley and we see with the alien as well when we get to the end of that film. So there was a different kind of theme that Cameron was touching on in that movie. And here this adds to the Alien universe. It's not trying to do exactly what those films did. It's trying to tackle something larger, much more grandiose and much more pretentious. It's really trying to get at. I give it credit for at least trying to do that, but I agree with you that there are a lot of problems where you have, for example, we go back to the moment where they are explaining what mission they're on. They're telling the other people why they're here, basically, what we're here to do, and we're here to meet these engineers. And one character says, but how do you know that they're really the people who created us? Why are we here to talk to them? She has that refrain. Shaw says, because it's what I choose to believe. Well, unfortunately, that may sound grandiose and work for the theme of the film because she has faith, but in that moment, I as a viewer, just like the scientists on that ship, I want to hear something concrete. I want to hear, well, I was really hoping in that moment that the screenwriters were going to be able to give me a 30-second snapshot of why they're there and what evidence they have that this is happening that would have set up the whole film in a really good way. Instead, it's because I choose to believe it. And so the screenwriter is basically saying, hey, audience, just go along with us. Just
trust
us.
And the screenwriter, we should note, is Damon Lindelof of Lost, or the co-screenwriter anyway. So he is someone who's maybe more interested in piling up riddle upon riddle than in having that moment where everything becomes clear. I mean, obviously, you don't want a scientist, you know, with a pointer in front of a whiteboard breaking it all down for you, right? But just to even believe in the plausibility of the mission and the fact that, you know, all these people would sign on.
They convince Weyland to spend billions of dollars to create the ship and come out to space. How did they do it?
Right.
Some
it's like we need a little more science and a little less fiction. Well, Adam, this was so much fun. Now I wish I could fly to Chicago every few weeks and spoil a movie with you.
I'd love to have you. That'd be great. It's really a thrill to be on. I'm a big fan of all things Slate. So thank you, Dana.
Oh, well, thanks so much. And we'll do it again, maybe remotely sometime. And thanks also to WBEZ Studios in Chicago for letting us use your taping space. The producer of this podcast is Andy Bowers. The executive producer of all Slate podcasts is also Andy Bowers. So for Adam Kempinar in Chicago, I'm Dana Stevens.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky?
In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.